Hello, on this week's program, as the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts celebrates its fifth anniversary, we speak with Mervon Mehta, the center's vice president for programming and education. Susan Lewis looks at a new public art project in Manayunk that celebrates and reinterprets a local tradition for socializing on stoops. Jason Pfeiffer speaks with the creators of This Is the Week That Is, the latest show from 1812 Productions. And we look at a new project at the Delaware Art Museum that uses technology to tell new stories about art. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Following decades of fundraising, planning, and politicking, and over 3 years of flurried construction, the Kimmel Center opened with great fanfare in December of 2001. By the time the first music was played, a star-studded eclectic concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Elton John, the venue had grown from its original mandate. Once billed as a new home for the Philadelphia Orchestra, it evolved into a multifaceted space with one large concert hall, a smaller theater, a performance studio space, educational facilities, reception rooms, bars, a restaurant, and a large enclosed public plaza. In its first 5 years, the Kimmel has pursued its broader mission to make a home for its 7 local resident performing arts groups and to present a broad array of performances from multiple genres. Mervon Mehta has been Vice President of Programming and Education at the Kimmel Center since shortly after it opened. I spoke with him earlier this week and first asked him what he felt the center's major achievements had been in its first 5 years.
We've put Philadelphia on the arts map. There are 700 to 900 performances every year, and on top of that, graduations, on top of that, corporate events, on top of that, award ceremonies, free in the plaza concerts, educational events from all of our resident companies and ourselves. So we've really become what they set out to become, which is a hub for the arts. Not without hiccups, a few. We've done what we had planned to do, but way back when the first shovel went in the ground. I think people stopped coming for the novelty of the new building after year one. Then we had to build up our audiences to find the true audiences that really, really wanted to come see a jazz series or a pop series or a classical recital series. And that's has been a slow go, and we've experimented with some things, and some things have been wildly successful. 5 years ago, if you told me just book a tango show and you'd sell out without trying, I would have said you were crazy. On the other hand, if you had said book a world-famous violinist like Maxim Vengerov, and you wouldn't have to worry, I'd say you're right. And in fact, the opposite has happened. We worried about Maxim Vengerov selling tickets, but we had no trouble selling the tango show. And our major problem is we don't have enough dates anymore. And we're looking a year and 2 years ahead now, not just next week.
How much has your job been about learning from the audience, and how much of it has been about informing the audience about artists they might not otherwise have discovered if they hadn't come to the Kimmel?
I think it's a balance. In the end, you have to sell the tickets. Otherwise, the artist isn't happy, the box office isn't happy, and the show isn't happy. So it makes no sense to bring the world's best spoon player from Scotland if 3 people are going to come to see it. So you have to experiment a little bit. But we have the beauty of having a 600-seat Perlman Theater as well, so we can do a little bit more experimentation there and not worry so much about the box office. And that's where we do our curated series and our contemporary classical series and our jazz series and some of our world music artists as well.
You've probably seen more shows in this hall than anybody alive. If I were to put the gun to your head, is there one or two particularly outstanding performances that you've seen here?
I probably couldn't answer that musically because there have been so many. But I think if you take the musical quality as a given, which hopefully most of our concerts are, but then I want to make sure that the successful night is not just about the music. It's about a full house of people who appreciate the music, that we've ticketed it at the right amount to ensure the full house, that we've gotten press and buzz created about the artist, that the artist comes in and goes, oh, my God, I love this place. When can I come back? So if you put all of those together, yeah, there have been a few that really just was magical nights. I would say one was the Katrina benefit we did last year with the Roots and several other special guests was incredible. From the artistic side, but the spirit was in the hall was incredible, and it was full.
If we were to have this conversation in 5 years, what do you think we'd be talking about looking back on 10 years of the Kimmel that will be different from what we're talking about today?
I think we'll be talking about the same sort of things. What concerts were great and what concerts were excellent and what concerts stiffed and didn't do so well and why, and then trying to figure out so that we don't do that again. I think the building continues to grow. We're continuing to find out new ways to use the building. I think one thing that I would like to change, I know that our board would like to figure out a way to change, is the whole way we interact with the public on non-concert times. Before a concert, any given night of the week, especially the Kimmel Center Presents concerts, the lobby is filled with people. We're having a free performance and kids are dancing or there's a student show or something going on. But that's kind of at 6 o'clock at night before an 8 o'clock show or at noon before a 2 o'clock matinee on Saturday. What about 10 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday or a Wednesday?
So to use the Commonwealth Plaza more as a community space, as a kind of an indoor park in the center of town.
Right. And we've experimented in the first couple of years with that. And it certainly wasn't for lack of trying, but there just isn't a lot of foot traffic coming into the center. So we've got to figure out a way to get more people down to this end of Broad Street. I mean, there were plans at the beginning, I know, to have performances all day free and have people come and bring their brown bag lunches. There's just not enough people around to do that. You can't do it for six people continually and you know, the artists aren't happy, and you got bills to pay too. Stagehands have to be paid, lighting has to be paid, artists have to be paid. So it has to be worth your while on some level, not to make money off it, but to have an experience. So how do we get back to that? How do we create more of that kind of environment in the plaza? It's a huge plaza. It's the biggest lobby of any theater that I know of in the world. And how do you fill it up? So there's all sorts of ideas about how to do that. There's ideas about signage on the outside of the building, video screens on the outside of the building to bring some of the performances inside out to the street on a permanent basis, not just a one time that the orchestra has done. So we're looking at those kind of things. So any way to liven up the plaza on off times would be great. Although I encourage everyone to come out when we're having a regular concert and see what goes on in the lobby before the concert happens.
Vice President for Programming and Education at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, Mervon Mehta. The Kimmel Center celebrates its fifth birthday next Sunday, December 17th, with an afternoon of free performances and events throughout the center, culminating in a ticketed evening performance in Verizon Hall by vintage Philadelphia soul group, the OJs. The Fairmount Park Art Association was chartered in 1872 to give artistic expression a place in the midst of the industrialization of so much of city life. Initially focused on adding sculpture to the vast landscape of Fairmount Park, as the years went by, its purview grew to include the city as a whole. As Philadelphia and its neighborhoods have evolved, so has the concept of public art. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores one of the association's most recent completed projects that actively celebrates the relationship between art and community.
New Landmarks, Public Art, Community, and the Meaning of Place was born about 10 years ago when the Fairmount Park Art Association leaders noticed that sculpture and other public art was largely concentrated in Center City, where most new construction was.
And we wanted to look beyond the center of the city because we felt that there was an interest in communities around the city to create public artworks that were reflective of their communities.
Penny Balkenbach is executive director of the Fairmount Park Art Association. She says that while New Landmarks was in some ways a new concept, it built on Philadelphia's strong history of creating art that mirrors its people.
For example, the Joan of Arc sculpture that sits near the museum, that was a commission that the Art Association arranged with the French community in Philadelphia for their centennial. These ideas of community involvement, of diversity, of celebration, are really traditions in Philadelphia in terms of public art. So we have a wonderful history that we can look to.
Seeking to encourage and facilitate this tradition, New Landmarks played matchmaker, with applications from community groups on the one hand and artists on the other. Communities described themselves, their ongoing projects and initiatives. Kay Sakura is director of a group within the Manayunk Development Corporation called the Schuylkill Project.
It is interested in reconnecting people to the waterfront in the Manayunk through East Falls area. What art does is it gives you that visual tweaking that makes it more interesting to people.
New Landmarks paired Manayunk with the two-person art team of local artist Diane Pieri and Seattle-based Vicky Scorry, although Scorry left the project for other commitments after the idea was chosen. On one recent windy day, Pieri said they began by exploring the neighborhood.
We walked around and we noticed that there were these extended steps in front of people's houses. If they don't have steps, they have couches or stadium chairs or anything that would bring kind of like a living room atmosphere out onto the front of their houses.
These outdoor gatherings were welcoming, and Pieri says they started asking people why they were sitting out on their stoops.
People said, oh, I used to put my kids out on the stoop and it would be like a babysitter. And then other people said, I've lived here 25 years and I've talked with my neighbors about everything, all the joys and the problems and everything. And I've never been in their house, but we've talked over the stoop.
Doing something with steps or stoops seemed particularly appropriate in Manayunk, says Pieri, because the community is itself terraced, built as it is into the hillside. The idea of bringing this stoop culture to the canal by creating freestanding stoops was enthusiastically embraced by the community. Pieri designed 9 concrete bases to be decorated in tile designs with themes of Manayunk and placed at intervals along the canal. A painter by training, Pieri started with a brush, painting each of the 9 stoop designs. The paintings and Pieri then went to Italy, where she picked out thousands of hand-cut Venetian glass tiles, color by color. Fabricators enlarged each design, cut them into jigsaw-like shapes, and set them in sheets that were then shipped back to Philadelphia. Over the course of 2 weeks, 3 installers, one from Italy and 2 from Florida, then laid the tile on the 3-dimensional concrete shapes. The result? Bench-like stoops and a spiral stoop. Stoops with images of hills, turtles, and fish. A stoop covered with the vibrant design of a Navajo rug, like the kind created in Manayunk when it thrived as a mill town. A garden stoop. And water stoops. Community members followed the installation with interest and a little help here and there.
I actually let them use all my water here. They needed water for the cement.
Linda Westfall, owner of Sportsworks on Main Street, has been in Manayunk for 20 years. She says nearly everyone has some interest in the canal.
People fish on the canal. You know, the people that have lived here forever, their ancestors worked in the mills. It has historic value. I run, I walk my dog, I go out and sit on the stoop and just meditate. Get a little break.
These community projects can stretch out over time. Manayunk was one of the first applicants nearly 10 years ago. The Schuylkill project director, Kay Sakura, says that since then, neighborhood culture everywhere has changed. Demographics, and with them habits, have evolved as young people, as comfortable socializing on computers as on front steps, move in.
The change in the neighborhood is it's still residential. The business community's pretty much stayed on the Main Street area, but has become college age, and they don't stoops it. So it becomes a historic reference.
The stoop art project may have all that much more meaning as it reinterprets an old tradition and introduces it to a new generation. Fairmount Park Art Association Director Penny Bach says the new landmark commissions often look to the past to create something contemporary, and can thereby reach across generations.
They tend to have a resonance with the people who have lived in the community for a long time, as well as people who are upcoming and new in the community, because there really is a meaning behind the work itself, and the work really encourages people to figure it out.
However beautiful, will the stoops help bring out people to the river as originally intended? Those at the Schuylkill Project are counting on it. According to Gwen Cohen, project manager, the stoops are just one step, so to speak, in plans that reach even beyond the canal banks.
The stoops are actually kind of the next level connection, and they're looking out over the island, which will be the park land which is being developed. It's a nice connection.
The next Schuylkill venture is Lower Venice Island, set to break ground in 2007 on land between the canal and the river. Plans include a 5-acre park, performance space, and athletic fields. With Manayunk and 2 others complete, New Landmarks has 2 more projects in development, one at 22nd and Burks and one in Elmwood Park. Meanwhile, in Manayunk, the stoops, colorful and welcoming, stand ready, just waiting for someone to come and sit.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And speaking of stoop art, Philadelphia's 1812 Productions is currently staging a show that features a sketch called The View from My Stoop, talking politics with Patsy.
There. What I'm going to do is I'm going to open some letters and see what questions people have about politics, and then I'll tell you what I think about it. All right? Okay. This first.
The opinionated Patsy, played by 1812's artistic director Jennifer Childs, is a fictitious correspondent from South Philadelphia who offers political commentary through parables. Her segment is just one part of a variety show that's the latest installment in the theatre company's annual holiday series. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, this year 1812's seasonal show explores and recreates the traditions of political satire.
The show is called This Is the Week That Is, Political Humor for the Holidays. It was partially inspired by the classic satirical late-night program That Was the Week That Was, or TW3, the television show which featured songs, commentary, and politically-based comedy sketches. Ran on the BBC for only 2 years before an American version debuted in 1964. It paved the way for late-night comedies like Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Jennifer Childs, who conceived and directs the new 1812 comedy, says that as bits of information about the old program kept surfacing in her research for past holiday shows, it became clear that the basic structure of the television series would work well for the theater company's purposes.
It seemed just kind of a perfect vehicle for a way to comment on the political situation of the day, at least for us, because it combined fake news and a variety show format. So it was really a really unique form.
Within 1812's tradition of developing a holiday show each year, the examination of comedy history is commonplace. Jennifer Child says it's important to understand where comedy has come from.
I'm sort of a comedic history nerd, so that plays into it too. But to look back at these forms, and some of these comedic forms have not changed, I feel like as we go forward and push the boundaries of what comedy is and look to what comedy's future is, we have to honor and pay homage to the people who really created and changed and busted open those forms. I feel like there's a lot to be learned.
In the spirit of honoring and learning from comedy of years past, specifically political humor, This Is the Week That Is tips its hat to a number of comedians who weren't afraid to tackle political subject matter. People like Will Rogers, Dick Gregory, Mort Sahl, and Tom Lehrer, a composer, pianist, and mathematician known for writing and performing a large body of satirical songs in the 50s and 60s.
This is the song that some of the boys sang as they went bravely off to World War III. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV.
In This Is the Week That Is, Stephen Wright and Tony Braithwaite celebrate the wit of Lehrer, but add their own modern spin.
You can see me on your TV. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get Osami, so send me a salami and watch it all on Fox. No need for.
Near
you.
The beginning of the show, there's also a video retrospective of political satire. It spans back to even before the days of the Greek dramatist Aristophanes, demonstrating just how long the comedic form has been around and how relevant some of the old routines still are. But the 1812 team was not interested in merely creating a montage of vintage political satire. Don Montre, the holiday show's assistant director, says that while the 1812 piece draws a great deal of inspiration from past satirical comedians and programs, including the present-day Daily Show from Comedy Central, the holiday show isn't about copying other material.
I mean, the only thing that we kind of do that's similar is we do news, we do topical stuff, but it's our take on it, it's our version of it, it's our point of view.
Because politics is ever-changing, a certain degree of flexibility is required over a 5-week show run. One way 1812 will keep their material fresh is through using what they call refillable structures in the show, segments where jokes and commentary about current events can be plugged into predetermined slots in the script. The cast also has a stash of random costumes and props backstage to pull from, as news analyzed and the show changes. Those consistently in headline news from week to week and day to day are usually those who hold political power. So figures like presidents and senators receive a good portion of the jabs with satire. According to Jennifer Childs, good political satire doesn't try to take safe, inoffensive, and neutral ground.
For me, political humor with no point of view or with no teeth is not very interesting. So there's a lot of point of view happening and in opposing directions, you know. We feel like we can be equal opportunity offenders. We will certainly take shots at both sides.
Of course, there are critics of political satire who feel it can be dangerous, breeding cynicism and discouraging civic engagement. But Dana Gale Young, This Is the Week dramaturg and an assistant professor in the communication department at the University of Delaware, contends that satire can be a positive influence.
Across the board with humor, there is the ability that humor has to get people to consider things that they wouldn't otherwise consider without disagreeing right away. So when you introduce something in a funny way that might otherwise be offensive to someone, you can at least get them to get out of their initial desire to counter-argue that message and get them to at least play with you a little bit to let that message in.
Young says that the ability to get people to consider other perspectives is where the power of humor really lies. Jennifer Childs agrees that political satire might actually have a constructive role to play in society.
One of the things that I kept coming up against is reading about all of this stuff. It's like, how do you make funny what is sometimes unbearably not funny? And for me, this whole process has been about another way of processing a lot of confusing information and about making the horrible bearable. And I feel like that's why it's been around for so long. That's why we can trace it back to the Greeks, because people have had this need to process this information and to somehow struggle through it through laughter since the beginning.
And as one of the last scenes in the 1812 show postulates, with characters dressed in futuristic spacesuits, there's little doubt people will continue to laugh in the tradition of political satire for many more years.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. This Is the Week That Is, Political Humor for the Holidays, is at the Adrian Theatre in Philadelphia through January 7th. As interest in visiting museums wanes, especially among the younger set, organizations must discover new ways to appeal to a new generation of potential museum goers. This is easier done for, say, a science museum that has a reason to be gory, flashy, and fantastic. But for more traditional institutions, such as those showcasing the fine arts, grabbing the attention of youngsters is a greater challenge. Starting today, if they don't already have their own, kids will be given a portable music player, an iPod, when they visit the Delaware Art Museum. And as they walk around the museum, they'll listen to stories about selected works of art. For example, there's a sculpture of a wrinkled but expressive eagle by British potter Robert Wallace Martin. As the curmudgeonly looking bird leers at the visitor can hit play to see what he's so cranky about.
What? You think you're so big? Look at these muscles, these talons. This beak could rip a dozen chunks out of you before you even puckered your lips. Sure, you're taller. So what? See these wings? Two flaps and I'm landing on your head. From there, without even breaking a sweat, I've reached the roof of this building. A tree on top of a mountain. The sky's the limit for me. I can fly so high you would...
The story was written by Stephen Rogers, not an employee of the museum, not an art historian, but one of 20 storytellers whose work was chosen for the project The Art of Storytelling, Bringing Visual Art to Life Through Stories. A call for entries was made in the summer, asking for creative stories inspired by 20 of the museum's works of art.
Museums have always depended on art history as the story that they most often choose to tell in their galleries.
Danielle Rice is executive director of the Delaware Art Museum. She thinks by offering more personal or creative interpretations of fine art, people who may not normally be comfortable in a museum will make a connection. After all, everyone loves stories.
Storytelling is an amazing medium for connecting people with the world around them. And artists are storytellers, and viewers are storytellers as well. So the missing piece here that we added was the creative storytelling component.
In addition to listening to stories while viewing art, kids and adults can visit a computer kiosk where they can create their own digital masterpiece.
There are a number of different backgrounds they can then choose, from Howard Pyle's studio to a storefront.
Incorporating images from the museum's collection, visitors will create their own work of art, choosing props and characters to set the scene. Then they can write and record their own stories about the work into the computer.
Their characters, and here we've got a range of buccaneer and colonist and warrior.
Matthew Fisher is president of Night Kitchen Interactive, the company which designed the kiosks and collaborated with the museum on the project. He says that although he knows of no other museum that has taken this exact approach, many places are looking for innovative ways to engage visitors.
There's a big trend more in museums now to give voice to the visitor, to let the visitor speak in one way or another. But it's still in its infancy, and it's really an interesting balance between the curatorial voice on the one hand, where curators tend to want to kind of maintain that control about what is said about the artwork and the artifacts, and then, you know, giving people the ability to reinterpret and remix their own vision of what this artwork is about.
By looking at the art while listening to a story, the hope is that the narrative will activate the viewer's own imagination. In some cases, the story follows the work quite literally, such as the case with Faith Ringgold's elaborate quilt full of imagery and words.
I will always remember when the stars fell down around me and lifted me up above the George Washington Bridge. I could see our tiny rooftop with Mommy and Daddy and Mr. and Mrs.
The name of the story quilt is Tar Beach, and the artist later created a children's book of the same name. Tar Beach is the rare example of an audio story that does relate directly to the work of art, not that the viewers would necessarily know this. According to Danielle Rice, there is a theory that the initial intimate connection may lead to a desire to learn more.
My hope is that this program, which is clearly meant to engage the creative juices of the viewers, will actually seduce them into wanting to know more and into wanting to look at art more closely. Certainly when they come here, they can get much more information about the works of art. But I think in some ways we don't necessarily want to prioritize the art historian's story in any way, because we do want to encourage people to engage with art creatively.
The Art of Storytelling project launches today, and all of the parties involved are anxious to see the reaction of visitors, both young and old. But in the meantime, the project has already been a success, in an unexpected way, as Matthew Fisher explains.
I always thought that in the end, the experience of the kids going through the gallery would be an inspirational one. But I never really thought so much about how much the actual competition of writing the stories in the beginning was going to be an inspirational aspect, and how the Delaware Art Museum told us that their attendance went up during right before the deadline, and that there was a lot of interest and excitement around that aspect of it. And that part really did surprise me pleasantly.
In fact, they received over 350 story submissions from all over the world. 20 were eventually chosen to be part of the audio tour. Anne Corso is Studio and Family Programs Manager at the Delaware Art Museum. She says although she's pleased with how everything has evolved so far, her hope is that the kids will feel the same way.
On a very basic level, I hope it just makes it fun for them. I hope they walk away saying, oh, you know, a museum isn't really a boring place. I got to use the computer. There are things for me to do, and to really send a message that we're trying to reach them. It's not just a place that their parents drag them and they have to be quiet, that they can participate.
Art of Storytelling, Bringing Visual Art to Life Through Stories, begins today at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington. The related audio stories are available for download online at storytelling.whatscookin.com.
Please remember to return your iPod to the front desk. We wish you all the best in creating your own storytelling adventures.
And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks to Tyler Melchior, Daphne Demopoulos, and Dennis Lawson. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.